This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Joyful, joyful.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
And good evening and welcome to the Spirit Lounge. You're with Rev Joy and I've got Red Towel for the night. So instead I've got Red Kath in. Kath, welcome. Good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
And we have David on the panel. Hi,
hello,
David.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Kath.
Tonight's guest is Reverend Carolyn Francis, and she joined the ministry team at Collins Street Baptist in February 2011 after 5 years leading the St Kilda Baptist Church. Prior to studying for her Master of Divinity at Whitley College, Carolyn completed a degree in political science at Melbourne University, dabbled in the corporate world, and worked in academic publishing. Carolyn is passionate about the theology of everyday life, encouraging spiritual growth in herself and others, and the possibility this might just transform the world. Alongside her role in nurturing the life of Collins Street Baptist Church community, Carolyn is leading the church's programs of civic and cultural engagement. You might find her watching the Western Bulldogs, lingering in a city cafe, or jogging along the beach, or just sitting down reading a book. Carolyn is married to Carl and they have two children. Welcome to Spirit Lounge, Carolyn.
Thank you, Joy.
Now, we thought we would get to know you a bit, and so we wanted to start off by asking you if religion played a part in your upbringing.
Religion did play a part in my upbringing. In fact, I was in church every Sunday from the first Sunday of my life.
You got lots of brownie points.
I have built up much treasure in heaven. I majored in Sunday school and minored in the rest of life, I say sometimes. So I have been well brought up in the church, which has many, many benefits and strengths and possibly a few weaknesses as well.
Can you tell us a benefit and a weakness?
Well, I feel really fortunate to have been part of a community that showed me an enormous amount of love from the very start of my life. There were always a huge number of people who were very interested in me and supportive of me, people beyond my own family, and they gave me the gift of faith. They always gave me this sense that there was something grander than me, something bigger than me, that I could be contributing to something that really mattered in the world. The downside was that it was sheltered. There was a lot about the world that I didn't know much of until that magical time so many of us reach when we hit university, and it turns out the world's a little bit bigger than the one we've known.
So did you just grow into being a Christian, or was there a conversion moment, or how did that all come about?
Well, like most good evangelical kids, I think there were more than one conversion moment.
You do it often.
Yes. We often know about our failings and our need to atone for them. So there's often more than one opportunity in life to be converted. The answer to your question is both. I grew into faith, but there were significant moments along the way where I felt I was making decisions and choices about faith. And probably what I've figured out since then is that faith is always a choice, and conversion happens ideally every day and sometimes more than once, because there are just many, many circumstances in life and many moments that require the decision, am I for faith and love and hope and life, or for something else?
It's interesting that you should say that, and maybe later on we'll get to talk about your love of writing. But I've always thought if you talk about faith and then accompany it with a full stop, then it's as if there's an arrival. And it's something different if you accompany it with a comma or an ellipsis, and it's as if there is more to be discovered. And faith is a journey,
Yeah, the great writer on spirituality, Dallas Willard, says it's a pity that we talk about salvation as this moment that begins our religious life instead of salvation being every day that we live with faith and love. And I think for me, choosing to live with faith is something that is expansive. It's something that opens me up to people and the world and God and all the possibilities of that, not something that gives me answers that have full stops at the end of them.
Was there ever a time when you turned your back or you rebelled against your religious upbringing?
Yes, I certainly spent a few years in my late teens and early 20s not in the church. It wasn't necessarily a really defiant turning my back on, but it stopped being an important thing for me. And I was aware that there were some aspects of the faith that I had grown up with that weren't able to gel with the world as I was seeing it and experiencing it. But I think God and I have never really been able to leave each other alone. And so even during that time, I would have considered myself a spiritual seeker or a student or a looker for the answers to big questions. I wasn't sure that I would find them in the church.
For me, I guess what kept me engaged with the church was the life of Jesus. Was there something about Christianity that kept you engaging with it?
I think for me, the sense of the vastness of the universe and the possibilities that held, and my sense that I was part of a bigger story, something larger than myself. Certainly the life of Jesus is inspirational to me, a central story in my own life. That's not necessarily what held me with faith at that point in time. I was very sad to not be part of a spiritual community, and perhaps in many ways that's what drew me back into the church rather than Christian convictions at that time. They came gradually.
So was it always the Baptist church?
I grew up in the Baptist church. Yeah. I have spent small periods of time in other denominations, for a while in the Uniting Church and for a while in a Church of Christ. When it came time to think about my ordination and the direction I was heading in terms of working within the church, for both my husband Carl and I, who had both grown up in Baptist churches, there was a sense that these were our people and they'd given us faith, and some of them might be our crazy people, but they're still our people. And so I feel like I'm contributing back to the people who loved me into my faith.
And does the Baptist church and your community of faith allow you, encourage you, compel you to think?
My answer is yes. The mm-hmm. particular community that I'm in and the people who are close influences on me, I think at the end of the day, we are the ones who decide whether we think or not, and no one can make us and no one can stop us.
Yeah, but there can be encouragements along the way, and we can learn how to think in a disciplined way, and we can be encouraged to understand thinking as part of faithing and loving.
Well, I guess the privilege for me now as a leader within the church is that rather than needing someone to encourage me, I get to encourage others to be people of faith with their brains well switched on.
Good work, I say.
We talked just before about thinking. Sometimes it's hard to get that balance between thinking and emotion. And I think we have churches where emotion, connecting to God through emotion, is very strong. And then we have churches where it's more intellectual. How do we go about getting a balance where you have that good intellectual input, but you also are encouraged to emotionally connect, which I think is very transforming?
I agree with you that churches tend to specialise in one or the other, and that there are not too many that really nurture both. I think it's a little bit of a conversation that needs to take place where we allow those two aspects of faith and spirituality to inform one another. Many of us have a personal preference for one or the other, although we all need both. I think a lot of us feel like we could live without one as long as the other was okay. For me, the need to make sense of the world intellectually is more important than the need to just feel good. And I certainly couldn't go to church just to have an emotional buzz if it didn't make sense. But I know there are other people for whom the emotional experience is what is really transformative, and I certainly respect that.
There are some people I come across that are deeply critical of the academic pursuit. You don't need it. All you need is your community and your God and Jesus and how you feel. You've done quite significant study over the years, and no doubt there might be some ahead of you if it's part of what you find to be refreshing. Could you talk to that criticism and critique it in a way that might be helpful for anyone listening to this that has an interest in what it means to formally learn how to think, but is maybe encouraged to rely more emotionally?
Well, I can say for me personally that I think studying theology saved my faith. So that's my experience that I'm coming from. I had a lot of questions. I'd had them from a very young age. I didn't know that really smart people in the world had applied themselves to answering those questions. And it was a massive relief to me when I discovered that. So it's hard for me to relate personally to the idea that engaging your intellect in considering your faith and your spirituality would be a negative thing. But I know there are people who say so. I think it comes from a fear that there is some kind of house of cards that our own thinking can somehow pull the magic piece out of and let the whole thing come tumbling down.
Rather than understand that God is in the thinking.
God is in the thinking. And I think the fear itself is what starts to dismantle things, not the thinking or the questions or the answers. And I really would encourage people to trust the process, that there are no questions that you can ask that will see God running from your side. There is no idea you can have, even if it's wrong, that will send God scurrying from your side.
Have you got any favourite theologians that come to mind?
I have very much enjoyed the work of Paul Tillich. He's not an easy read. I will grant you that. But his idea about the conversation that takes place between culture and the history of our faith in the texts and also the traditions, and the way those things and personal experience are all in conversation, that's been a really important insight.
And his approach to depression and the abyss.
Yes, he writes a lot about the abyss. Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty chirpy person by nature, so that perhaps doesn't appeal to me as much as it does to some. I've also found the work of Miroslav Volf really helpful.
Well, that's an easy read. Not.
Some of it. His work, Exclusion and Embrace, is just one big spiritual hug for hard times.
Is there any theologians, that people who are not maybe quite as intellectual as you two, like people like me, might connect with on a...
I find the books of Barbara Brown Taylor really helpful. She's a beautiful writer, and she gets inside your head and tells stories and uses images that I think are very helpful. Mm. And that's not a tough intellectual read.
And Rowan Williams as well, ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, can write to anybody in the world, but he's written a number of little texts that are very beautiful to read, and there's no sense of dumbing down.
I love him. I don't know that I agree that he's an easy read for your everyday spiritual thinker.
Not all of his books are, but he's written some.
Yeah. I like him very much.
Okay, we'll agree to disagree on Rowan.
Now, we've got you at Whitley Bible College. How did you get from being in the corporate world to suddenly one day or over a period of time deciding that you're going to become a Baptist minister?
She did it what for the money, that? Joy.
Oh, and the prestige.
I did, and the favour amongst people. My story of being in a corporate position working as a consultant with one of the big international management consulting firms was that, despite the fact it promised the world, I found doing the work profoundly unsatisfying. So while it might sound like I made some sacrificial choice in terms of vocation, the truth is I didn't enjoy it. I found it shallow. it offended values that I didn't at that time realise that I had, and I didn't want to do it anymore. When it comes to studying theology, it happened a little bit by accident. I did one subject in the evening just out of interest. It was not part of a grand plan to become a minister or do anything righteous and holy at all, really. And I turned up one day to do a subject and I stayed for a really long time.
That was it.
It's a bit like me. I went to do one subject and ended up as a minister.
And you're still there, Joy, studying away?
Oh, not at Whitley, though. I only went to Whitley because I was told it was the most liberal college in Melbourne and I shouldn't go there. Is that true, that it's most liberal?
No, it's not. It's not at all. There are different subjects there, and there are some that are taught from a more progressive perspective. There are quite a few that are very standard biblical studies type subjects from that approach. Most importantly, though, I think that the attitude of the faculty there is that you need to explore and find your own answers. They encourage honest, rigorous scholarship, which I think is a good thing.
Would you think it's fair to say that there's a gentleness there as well for people who are genuinely inquiring?
That was my experience. To be honest, it has been a number of years now since I've been a student there, but it's certainly a place that for me gave me permission to ask questions and gave me the resources to find some answers or at least grapple with the answers, and I'm really grateful.
Yeah, I think gentleness is really underrated.
Whitley was the place that I heard that it was okay to be a Christian and be gay.
Well, I'm very glad that you heard that.
Is it okay to be a Christian and gay?
Yeah, I know. But I learnt that at Whitley by going to Whitley.
Well, I probably learnt that at Whitley too in one way or another.
There's a couple of key people up at Whitley that have done some very lovely thinking about that as well.
They have.
Yeah. I mean, I must admit that their pastoral care subjects were what drew me to Whitley because I love that. So, yes, anyway, enough talking about Whitley now. We'll get on to more interesting things. Well, I shouldn't say that.
Actually, can I just say one thing before we do move on from Whitley?
Yep.
I think there is a point to be made really clearly that for anyone listening out there that thinks you can't marry theology and being LGBTI, there are colleges and formal institutions that will welcome you, and there are interesting and creative teachers that will engage with you.
And more than welcome you, they actually, I found it was quite interesting, the support I got throughout my time there.
I'm really pleased to hear that.
It's a really important point to make for anyone that's listening out there. It's worth actually researching and asking your own questions about that.
So I'm interested to explore this. When you were growing up, what was the view of the church you went to on homosexuality? Did they talk about it? Did they?
I can imagine what the view might have been, but I'm not sure that it ever came up in conversation. I certainly went to university not having knowingly been in conversation with someone who was gay before then. I didn't have strong views on it. It's not like I'd heard hellfire and brimstone sermons, but my assumption at that time was that it would have been considered outside of God's ideal plan. But I didn't carry strong feelings, and I was grateful for that, because when I met wonderful people who were gay when I was at university, it was not a difficult thing for me to marry my faith and my love and care for those people.
Well, Karen, we will pick it up that after some music that you've brought in. Can you introduce this first track that we've got called Think? Why that?
Well, Kath was talking before about the importance of thinking and faith, and I wish that I could say that this is the reason why I chose Aretha Franklin's Think. The truth is actually far less impressive.
It's the Blues Brothers, isn't it?
It's a lovely memory I have. It is from the Blues Brothers, but my memory of this, which just cannot help but make me smile, is that when my kids were very small and I worked hard as a full-time minister, on Mondays I would have the day off, and in the morning we would stay in our pyjamas. We didn't have to go anywhere, and we would dance and sing around the house, and this was our favourite. So I have this image of my daughters, aged 2 and 3, in their pyjamas, singing back up as I took on Aretha Franklin's Think.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. Okay, we have a message Are you ready for this? You
I
two have
ready.
To answer this question. How do you determine whether any part of the Bible is literal rather than a metaphor or specific to the times in which it is written? And that is from Tony.
Well, I think that's a really good example of Tony thinking and asking a question that's not only clever, but something that probably persists in a lot of people's minds. But I'm going to hand it over to Carolyn because she's here to answer questions.
That is
today.
Really, really.
I'm happy to, but my voice is not needed
well,
today.
I'm happy to give it a go. It is a great question. The first thing I want to say about it is that there is nobody who takes every sentence in the Bible literally. No one. When Jesus says, I am the bread of life. There is no one who believes we are talking about a literal loaf of bread. So let's be clear about the fact that no matter who we are, when we go to read the Bible, we have to discern how we're going to approach each part of it. A big part of it is understanding genre. If there was one thing I could teach people about the Bible, that would be it. In our own culture, when we hear something begin with once upon a time, we know what it is. It's going to be a fairy tale. When we hear something end with amen, we know it's a prayer. When we hear something begin with on Saturday the 26th at 9:30 a.m, we know that it's some kind of historical report. There are clues like that in the text in Scripture that tell us how we should engage with certain parts of it, and we need to get better at teaching people how to note those things. However, I do need to say that it's not always as clear as that. And for me, discerning how we engage with different parts of Scripture is something that needs to happen in community. For me, that's part of what's so important about belonging to church, that we don't sit on our own and figure out what this means just for me. We need to work together to work some communal wisdom on how we engage with the different parts of Scripture. And we were talking before about the conversation idea. I think it's a conversation between what we know in Scripture, what we know in the world we live in and the culture, what we know from experience, and we gain wisdom by putting those things together.
I remember at Bible College, there was two women who were absolutely devastated to the point where they left the course because they found out that, you know, Jonah didn't get swallowed by a whale, literally. And yet I know for me it was just so liberating when I first heard that these stories that I'd been brought up on and been told were all true weren't actually literal. I mean, they didn't really happen. But they are there for a reason. They're part of the culture. They're part of the storytelling of that nation.
They are. And it's a great pity that we say things like, oh, it's just a myth or just a metaphor, because actually those things can be more powerful and more true than literal statements. They're true in a different way. I think it was one of my kids who said to me once, oh, Mum, just because it didn't really happen doesn't mean it's not true.
Fantastic. That's a good point.
I've always found it helpful to try and think about things in 3D and ask myself, what is it that's sitting behind the story? So we think about a man and a whale being swallowed. What's actually sitting behind that story? And what's sitting in front of it? That might be a bit sort of out there in terms of people looking at words on a page, but it helps me take any semblance of a 2D understanding that something is, therefore it is, rather than, you know.
Absolutely. And I think we employ these ideas really easily when it comes to cultures that are not our own, but not very well when it comes to our own. If you ask someone about Aboriginal Dreamtime stories who's not an Indigenous person, they never say, oh, it's literally true, or they don't say, well, it's not literally true, therefore it has no value. They say, it may not be literally true, but here's the beautiful message that it conveys about the land and how it's precious and how we are to live in harmony with it. We need to learn to say the same things about Scripture.
I wonder if it's because in many ways in society we've lost the art of storytelling. I mean, I was brought up with a grandfather and grandmother, and we used to sit around the fire and hear stories of their life. And it was just fabulous. And I think, you know, for many ways that we have lost that.
And I wonder what that means in terms of understanding the art of dialogue, and in that, the art and the discipline of disagreeing without necessarily seeing it has to be a fight and descend into conflict. And that stories can help us do that.
They absolutely can, and they remind us that the purpose of faith is not to have the absolute answer to every question. Sometimes people who are religious major in the answers rather than in listening to the questions. Sometimes they don't even need there to be a question before they give the answer. I think stories give us permission to ask a whole lot of questions, to muse upon what might be, to grapple with ideas without actually having to come to conclusions.
And there's some amazing stories in the Bible. I've been preaching a couple of weeks, and I've been reading the story of the beheading of John the Baptist. I thought, what do you do with this?
And then, it's juicy.
You know, a fabulous story when you actually look at it. And then
not for John the Baptist.
No. But I was a bit...
Just saying.
He should be a bit peeved because it said in the last voice, and his disciples came and took his body and put him in a tomb. And I thought, oh, where's the wake and the fanfare and the state funeral?
I mean, the resurrection.
Really? Yeah, exactly. But I was linking it in with the Samuel reading where David danced before the ark. And there's some really neat stories in the Bible. I get really excited by them.
And actually, now you're talking, and I'm thinking back to the point that was made before about thinking and emotions. Stories give us a framework to do that. If you think about, you know, what it means to respond emotionally to a story that's a little bit distant from something that we need to consider as fact, we can then also have the space to think what's actually being said here.
And not just the space to think, but the space to empathise and have compassion, the space to put ourselves in someone else's shoes,
yep.
The space to consider whether there's something at work for the people involved, the people implicated in the story that we don't yet understand, and therefore we need to be curious about, ask questions about. Maybe we need to approach it with wonder and wondering rather than with answers.
Yeah, and a space to deal with what it means to have fear, anxiety, fury, disappointment in the midst of all of that.
And this is why I love reading novels.
Aha.
And I think almost a space to not even understand.
Yes, mystery.
You know, just to sit with it and go, well, I really don't know what this is on about, but it's a good story.
It opens up the possibility that having the easy answers to something is actually not the point of the exercise.
Well, it opens up the question, I wonder what this is about, doesn't it? Rather than I need to work it out.
And your next track is a track called Joyful Girl. Tell us about this one.
Joyful Girl is actually an old Annie DeFranco song, but the version that I love most is by a band called Soul Live, which is the Dave Matthews jazz band. And this is a bit my theme song, Who I Want to Be When the World Gets Hard.
I do it just because I want to, just because I want to.
Joy 94.9.
And Tony sent back a message saying, thanks, girls. Hope I didn't muck up your script too much. What script, I ask. But no, Tony, we're happy to answer any questions. And we have another message from Peter from the Cabaret Room and formerly a Baptist. And he says, loving the show, Joy and Carolyn. And, of course, he meant to add Kath.
I don't take these things personally.
Thank you, Carolyn, for all you do for Melbourne's DSG community. So we have been talking about lots of different things, but I'm interested in talking about marriage equality, because you were starring in speaking at the rally, weren't you, recently?
I did speak at the recent rally in Melbourne. I've been involved in the campaign for marriage equality for a number of years now, and it's something that I simply help out with when I am asked to do so, and it's something that I strongly support and hope that that's a reality that we're discussing soon rather than a campaign.
How did you get involved in it?
I had said a number of things in small forums about my grief at the way Christians were participating in the debate about sexuality broadly, but marriage equality specifically. Every time I turned on media, it seemed that when marriage equality was discussed, there was a curiously well-funded Christian lobby group saying things that in no way represented or even resembled the faith that I held dear and was practicing. And so it began with me simply wanting to say, they don't speak for me. It has become more than that since then, but that's still key to my message. When I hear things that come from a place of fear or even hate, I want to make it very clear that there are many, many Christians who in no way share those views.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I get a bit sick of Facebook when we continually, people continually post things about Christians, say negative things, and yet we don't seem to post enough about Christians. And there's a lot of Christian ministers out there who are actually supporting marriage equality, and yet we don't, you know, speak up or we don't post enough about them.
Well, I mean, I think we need to, those of us who are Christians, need to own the fact that there are people who are Christians who do say terribly unhelpful things.
On behalf of all Christians.
On behalf of all Christians. And we need to acknowledge that that's out there. And yes, those of us who think and feel differently do need to speak up. I try and do that in my own way. And the truth is that those of us who have those views often don't have the media campaign budget that some of our friends on the other side might have. So we need to find other ways to share the message. I think that there's a place for everyone in God's world.
And Caroline, the reality is, I find it a very harsh and sad reality that the church as an institution, as many institutions, hold the capacity to make laws that to a certain extent can control what many people who are formerly part of the church as ministers can in fact do. Can you speak a little bit about that in the context of the Baptist Church and what it means for you, how it's impacting you now and what you think the future is going to be?
Well, interestingly, one of the principles of being Baptist historically has been liberty of conscience, freedom of conscience. So I hold strongly to that. I don't think any church can actually tell people what to believe in or what to think. They may try. I don't believe we ought to. So within my own denomination, whilst it is true that the view I hold is a minority one, there is a general understanding that people are entitled to hold and express their own perspective. Unfortunately, conformity of belief has become far more important to people within the church, including the Baptist Church, than it ever should have been. I think that at a time when the church is waning in influence generally, there's a fear about the church's loss of its place in the centre of society, that some people respond to that by thinking that what holds us together and keeps us strong is believing in exactly the same things and firming those up as strongly as we possibly can. I don't agree with that. I think we can actually be a strong community whilst holding a range of beliefs. I think it's our practices together and our common commitments to love and justice that hold us together. It will change. There are plenty of us who want it to.
To be a little bit provocative, do you think there's a point at which you can imagine yourself saying no? Now, in my mind, I think about what it would be to be a Christian in the apartheid era at South Africa. And I imagine at some point people just said, no, I can no longer align myself with this. Can you imagine coming to that place?
I can imagine it, and I don't anticipate it happening. There are times when I have felt extremely frustrated with the church, and I have been asked many times by people, why do you persist? And I think it's a fair question. People who would say, this institution has damaged me or damaged other people, how can you be part of it? There's a few answers to that. One simple one is that the people in my church, including members of the LGBTI community, say to me that they don't want me to give up on the church, because they want a place to belong. Faith and church are important to them. And they say, don't hand it over to the other guys. Where will we go if that happens? So for me, as long as it's a place that those people seek to belong to and that remains important to them, I'll still be there. There are other reasons too. I still fundamentally believe in a redemptive community. I still believe that even though we fail again and again, that the idea and sometimes the reality of a community based around love and giving and faith and hope and peace, that's still something I want to be part of. It might not be redeemed from any direction other than from the inside.
So you can, in your mind, I don't want to use the word separate, but compartmentalize what it means to be part of an intimate local faith community and have that situated in the context of a denomination which may formally hold a position on equality for all people that runs contrary to the faith community that you're part of. That's kind of what you're talking about.
It's a tension, yep. I grant you, but it's a tension that I hold. The reality is that we all belong to things that we don't give our full consent to. There are things that happen in Australian society and public policy decisions that are made by our government that I wish were not made. I'm not about to move. And I feel the same way about the church. I will work within it to change it as best I can. I'll be grateful for the ways in which it does good. I will apologise for the ways in which it does what is not good. And I'll do my best to make it a life-giving, fair, inclusive, just place.
In your own context?
In my own context, but in a wider context too, as much as I'm able.
As someone who benefits from going to Connor Street Baptist Church, I want to say that it is really important that we have churches like that and ministers like you and Simon who are willing to do what you do. And it comes at a cost. I mean, the other Sunday we had people yelling throughout our whole service because of your standing up for marriage equality.
Yes, those people would have done well to go to their own church, which was a reason why churches would be good, wouldn't it? It would have been good for them to be practicing their own faith within a church on that day. Look, yes, you cop criticism for standing up for ideas and principles. That doesn't faze me. It's really unfortunate that things like that happen because of the effect they have on people. There are people who find that disruptive. There are people who find it very traumatic. There are people who should simply just not be subjected to that when they come to church.
But I think what was really encouraging for me was to see the oldest members of that congregation who were really indignant about the fact that these people were doing what they were doing and that they were upsetting members of our, you know, of our congregation.
Absolutely. And, you know, none of those people are going to be on the 7 o'clock news ever. And we need to remember that the church is full of people like that, not just the people with megaphones. There are many, many good people who would always stand up for someone's right to come and practice their faith in their church without disruption and without the need for anyone else to agree with them on every other issue.
So what you're actually saying, Caroline, is that there are safe churches in Melbourne. For people who are not heterosexual.
There are safe churches in Melbourne. They're not perfect churches.
No,
but
that's
they
not what
are
I said, though.
Safe churches. Yep. That is right.
I think that's really important.
I don't think a perfect church exists.
Of course it doesn't. Of course
if it does, it's closed and there's no people.
Well, if it does, it doesn't have people. I mean, that's the reality.
Where two or more are gathered, there will be a fight, but a safe one.
That's right. I mean, I think complete lack of conflict or complete agreement on everything is not what actually makes a vibrant spiritual community.
No, but to go into a church where you hear people, the ministers and other people talking openly from the pulpit about GLBTI issues, that's what makes a church affirming and accepting. To have the older people in the congregation indignant because these people are out there yelling throughout our service, that's what makes a church welcoming.
It actually takes it beyond affirming into being advocates, doesn't it?
For sure. And I think that it's important to note that that's part of a wider theology. It's not just a particular issue that we've become enthusiastic about, although we are. It's actually because we hold a set of values and beliefs and practices which are about justice and inclusion and welcome and hospitality and love. We were talking before about, you know, which parts of the Bible do you take literally? Well, maybe the bit about loving your neighbour We'll start with that. Let's take that one literally.
Yeah, loving people that are marginalised. Wow, there was a big, you know, we heard of someone else who did that, you know, way back and when. And, of course, as usual, we've run out of time, so we might have to get you back one other time.
I would love to come
back. So that we can talk about lots of other things that we're going to talk about tonight, but never really got to. So, Carolyn, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Rev Kath, it is great to have you back on the show tonight.
It's good to be here. And, Carolyn, thank you for being a voice of kindness and reason.
Kindness and reason are good things.
Amen. Now, Carolyn, do you want to introduce this next track for us?
I do. This is my favourite song at the moment. It is the song that is featured in the recent film Selma. It's called Glory by John Legend and others. It is an inspirational call to believe that good things will come in our fight for justice.
And here is a Glory. And that is goodbye from Rev Joy.
Goodbye from Kath.
Goodbye from Carolyn.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.